said now, it just gives it a little opportunity to warm up. Well, Ms. Parsons, before we get into your career, it would be interesting to know about you and your lineage. Perhaps you could.
Yes, I shall go a little farther back to the Gleasons. We, our families, derived the scholarly trait, I think, from the Gleason family. That was old Grandpa Gleason was a missionary to the Mohegan Indians, and he figured large in our family chronicles. He was the grandfather of my mother, my mother's mother's father. And the whole family seemed to have been rather scholarly. His sister was a member of the Scribner's staff, and her referred to in books like Laredo Taft's autobiography. I have found that he delighted when he went to Scribner's to talk with Miss Gleason. So the Gleasons figured quite largely. My mother was born at Grandfather Gleason's mission. And when I was at Yale, I thought it interesting to go and look up Grandpa Gleason. So I went over to the region there in Connecticut that the old mission would be supposed to be, and I found something on the map that said Mohegan, and I told the conductor of this little conveyance, I told I wanted to stop there. Oh, he said, there isn't anything there but an old church. Fine. So I got off and found the old church, and lo and behold, above the pulpit was a large and enlarged picture of my great-grandfather Gleason. There it was. So I scouted around and found the home of an old Indian woman of the Mohegan tribe who had been a child in my grandfather Gleason's church. So she pulled open a drawer and handed me out pictures of many of my relatives, my mother as a baby. She was a twin. And so it was very interesting. So then later I went up to New York and found standing the old wooden church that my grandfather had built for another tribe of Indians. So I traced them around. My grandfather is down in the annals of the Congress for having applied for his church there at Mohegan. He applied for $600 a year. That was his salary, but he had to go before Congress to get his salary. So he had $600 to build his churches, to run his affairs, to support his family. Of course, dollar didn't mean the same in that time, but it was interesting.
When was this?
I don't know. I have various paintings of the old, I have photographs and paintings, and, well, this Grandfather Gleason wrote a very interesting autobiography that has been filed with the, I believe, the Massachusetts or the Connecticut Historic Society, because he was quite scholarly, and this tells all about it, but I don't remember.
Would you guess it was around the 1840s, 1850s?
I suppose so. I could verify that. I could look up the record. My father's family was a pioneer family in Indiana. They were scholarly after a fashion. They believed in education, and my father's mother lived with us, and she could tell about the old days very entertainingly, and she was a friend of a good many scholarly people there. I can't remember who they were, but she told us tales about this and the other person that's down in the history of pioneer people. So we had traditions of scholarliness and owning books and magazines and papers. My father took some books and magazines in his car when he went in those old sod houses. He would bring things to loan to people that hadn't any printed word. And that was a scholarly thing. I remember one old fellow saying to him, I had to chuckle to myself as a child, this old fellow said to him, "Doctor, I'm interested in those stories in those magazines you bring, but there's one author that never seems to come to the point, and his name is Toby Conclude." So I went with my father, and there were he was fond of horses. He was a good driver. He loved driving his team. We had two horses. They hitched to this little country conveyance, and we forded rivers. We went around the great fires, the prairie fires. I remember some of those. I never was afraid of anything. I trusted my father. And we went around these great prairie fires. We forded rivers where there weren't any fords. It was really very interesting. We went to the Second Ward School there at Arkansas City. And my Aunt Dick, who brought us a good deal of the tradition of that scholarliness, she was the principal of this Second Ward School. And so that was her last year in the school when I was 5 years old, so I was allowed to enter the first grade. We didn't have things like nursery schools or anything like that. We went right into the first grade. And so I entered, and all through that board school, I was so tiny that I had to carry a little stool to the school to put my feet on, because there wasn't, of course, every room was graded with big seats and medium-sized seats and smaller seats, but the smaller was never small enough, so I carried my little stool to put my feet on. Then it was this Aunt Dick that married Professor Miller, who was the head of the chemistry and pharmacy department in the old API, Alabama Polytechnic Institute, and they offered to have me come there. And there, as I said, I was one of 14 co-eds in a military school. It was very hot in June when we took our examinations, but I remember that the young gentlemen were not allowed to take off their padded coats and button clear up under their chins, so they were just expiring. But with young ladies present, they weren't allowed. There was a room provided down the hall. Any young gentleman that would like to take his coat off may go down the hall and take his coat off down there, but not in this room where young ladies are present. So it was that kind of quite a southern atmosphere. And as I told you, I didn't graduate because there was a fiery Confederate history, and I would have been the butt of all kinds of notice and jokes, and so I didn't graduate there.
You mean you just decided not to?
I decided not to, yes. So the degree didn't mean much to me. So I didn't graduate from that. But then I came back to, I think it was then that I taught the country school after I came back from Alabama. It was not very far from home, and I got the munificent salary of $27.50 a month. I held out for $30, and they wanted $25, so we split at $27.50 a month. And they were scholarly people. They were delightful people to be with, and I still correspond with the daughter of that family. The two daughters have a biography. They wrote together an autobiography, and that is in this this museum that has been founded that I am contributing to. All of the history that I can get together. These two Phillips girls wrote their autobiographies. One has died. I knew her down in Lakeland, Florida, but the other one is in the East, and I still correspond with her. So I keep connections with that country school, but it was otherwise a hideous memory because the big boys just about ran me out. I knew nothing about discipline. It was a long day. I built the fire in the morning, waded through snowdrifts, built the fire in the morning, supervised the school. I had 27 classes during the day. I began with the first grade and got the eighth grade ready to take their county examinations to go into high school. And the front row was for the class. They would come then to the front row and I'd hold the class. The rest were supposed to be studying. They might be throwing spitballs or anything, but I had the reciting class on the front. So it was then I stayed after school to sweep out the school, to erase the boards. I didn't seem to know how to get monitors, but I did all of these things, got in the kindling for the fire for the next morning. The Lollapaloozers were heated, the luncheon. Lollapaloozer was a kind of a pie that had meat and potatoes and things in, and those were taken out of the lunch boxes and put up on this flat top of this base burner, and they'd be nice and hot by the time that the children had their meal. Well,
you must have been in your very early 20s at this time, weren't you?
Yes, because I graduated from high school at 16. So I don't know, I might have been 18 or 19 long then.
I see.
You see, I started at 5, so I went on up through the school rather fast. Well, let's see.
Where did you go from this country school in Arkansas City?
Well, then I think that was the time that I began earning a little money. We moved out to the country. You see, I went to the Second Ward School when we lived in town, but my father was born and bred a farmer. He was a pioneer, so he didn't like the town, so he bought 2 miles out of town, he bought a little farm, built a house there, and there I learned to garden and to like crops. And this spring, after I got through the country school, I think I stayed at home then that winter. Then the next spring, I raised tomato plants in the house, but didn't put them out. Everybody else in all that region put out their tomato plants just in time for a great big freeze. I put mine out just after the big, great big freeze. I had the entire whole scope of all of that part of Kansas to myself. My tomatoes bore well. There was no competition. I had the whole tomato crop. I sold tomatoes, and the price kept up because I had captured the whole crop. So I actually accumulated enough money to take my sister and myself to the summer session of this teacher's college that just had been organized at Pittsburgh, Kansas. And girls, then there was a home economics department organized there that all the girls who came there seemed to go to. Mm-hmm. That seemed to be a budding career. Mm-hmm. There was much offered about future careers, and it was true that home economics came into its own, and the demand for home economics teachers was great. And so clear into my college days, the demand was great. Mm-hmm. It was a good field, an excellent field. Clear in through my days of Dr. Mendel at Yale, trained home economics women to be heads of departments. He was very sympathetic to home economics. He liked these heads of home economics women that came to him for their doctor's degrees. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was a rather natural thing. That summer session at Pittsburgh was interesting because it introduced me to something beyond the high school. Mm-hmm. But with our scholarly background, my sister and I could judge that that place was not a scholarly place. Mm-hmm. It wasn't only the curriculum, it wasn't scholarly. The people there were not scholarly. We, with our scholarly background of our families, we could judge. So we had heard that KSAC was a more scholarly place, as indeed it was. So my father, by that time, my father didn't collect his debts. He was a gentle soul. He couldn't bear to tell people that they had to pay their debts. They'd put up a story about privation, and so they would often offer something in the way of services. There were the Prettymans who were photographers, and the Prettymans offered to take out their medical debts, so that I suppose there wasn't a family in Kansas that had its picture taken so many times as our family. Oh my, the children pictures that we have. So it's been very nice to have those. Sure. But he did collect some debts, so that then by fall, when we weren't satisfied with pictures, he could finance us to go to KSAC. And there, as I said, we used our background. It was still an alluring field. Most of the women at KSAC went into home economics. It was a promising field. We could use our credits, and so we went into home economics there with wide electives. We could take what science we wanted to. And right away, I elected bugs for, let's see, I believe that's ornithology. Yeah. What is it?
No.
What is, well, anyway, it studied bugs by a very scholarly man. I got a glimpse at once of organized science, because of course these creatures were classified. I just reveled in it. I learned everything by heart. I still can recite the names of a great many of the bugs that my little 4-H children are interested in. I know that background. So then that led me into chemistry and physiology, and so the enriching of home economics with science became a very potent sort of thing to me that I understood. And so my sister and I both graduated there at KSAC. Then,
excuse me for interrupting, but did other women who were your classmates, for instance, did they also share your interest in science?
Not that I can remember. I think it was obligatory to take some science, but I can't remember any that shared my enthusiasm. My sister, to some extent, she didn't embrace it with the enthusiasm that I did. So I can't remember any companions in this enthusiasm. So, but it just captivated me. I hadn't encountered anything, as far as I can remember, I didn't encounter any science in high school. It was languages. I was to be a Latin teacher when I went to this teacher's college at Pittsburgh. I had hoped that there would be a department of Latin because I'd taken 4 years of Latin in the high school. My Latin teacher was a scholarly person. That's what attracted me. And there was no doubt about it, I was to be a Latin teacher. Oh my, I'm so glad I got diverted from that. I remember in the University of Chicago, which I see I don't have down here at all, in the University of Chicago, I had a very good friend. She was getting her PhD in Latin, and I remember that she was studying the dative case in Cicero, I believe, or if he had dative cases. But it was one construction that she was studying in one writer, and that was to be her PhD thesis.
It wasn't for you.
Not for me. Well, then I was interviewed for a job, and I was all so timid. I didn't have any feeling of how to go about it, and so I didn't get the jobs I was interviewed for. So again, I stayed at home for a while, and then they passed on this Oklahoma job in the middle of the year. I don't remember how far along it was, but their teacher had married and left, and here they were very proud of their home economics down in this little Oklahoma school. It was so well financed. I tell you, the Indians in those days down in Oklahoma, they got financed. I can't remember what the gimmick was, but this school had plenty of money, and they were so anxious for a teacher that they took me without any interview at all on the basis of the recommendation of KSAC. If I had been interviewed, I don't doubt I'd have lost that place. I didn't have the slightest confidence, but I went down there, and oh, I just loved it. I began with the third grade, and then I alternated cooking and sewing, cooking and sewing, clear through the high school. I had all those classes, and they were nearly all Indians, and they were just charming children. They were delightful. They were lovely children. So, and I had a lovely place to stay with very scholarly people. And it was a very nice experience. I tried to improve on my capacity for this place by visiting some people, towns in Ohio, I think it was, maybe Indiana, who were teaching sewing and cooking down through the grades. That intrigued me. I thought I'd specialize in that. So it was a new thing to teach cooking and sewing in the grades. So I visited in a scholarly research different towns that were teaching it. Then, as I said, this Aunt Dick and her husband, Professor Miller, he was pursuing his PhD. So they found that Professor Watts was going to be away on a vacation for the summer, he and his wife, and would like to have somebody take care of their house for them. And it was a great big house. And they, so this aunt and Professor Miller invited my sister and me to come. And the home economics head was Abby Marlatt, who was quite a famous person in her time. She had come from Kansas. In fact, her father had owned all the land that KSAC was built on. Mm. So she had an immediate interest. And as we interviewed her for courses that we could take, and I remember it was an interesting interview, very characteristic. She asked if I had ever taken anything under Miss So-and-so. Yes, I said, yes, I had a course there in meal serving. Well, what do you think of her, she said. Oh, I said, she was a good teacher, but she had no sense of humor. Oh, Miss Barlett threw up her arms. Oh, Miss Barlett said, my poor brother. It seemed that her brother, who was a very famous man, was engaged to this teacher of mine. And that was my introduction to Miss Marlatt. Oh, my poor brother. And she was a woman of a great deal of ability. So we signed up several courses that she recommended, and one was meal serving in the home management house. So my sister and I lived for a week in the home management house. And I, when she came to be part of the group when we served meals, the noon meal, and so when it was my turn to be hostess, I made some place cards. And I remember the ditty that I fixed up for this place card. The place card said, chemical life is a life for me. A chemical cook I mean to be. For life on this earth, be it fast or slow, is a matter of air and H2O. Well, it seems that was a center shot, I learned afterward, that was the thing that Miss Marlatt selected me as her assistant for.
Really?
Because that was her ambition, to correlate home economics with basic science. That was the thing, because she had led a scholarly life in some of the Eastern colleges. And that was her ambition, and here it was, stated on this place card.
That's really fascinating.
And so at the end of the summer, she offered me this place, and I turned it down. I loved my Oklahoma school. Mm-hmm. Then I got home and told them that I had turned that down, and did I get a raking over from my family? Why, this would lead ahead. Oklahoma wouldn't lead anywhere. The University of Wisconsin, and I had turned it down. So I revised my decision and accepted it. So.
Now this was in 1913.
1913. So my first task was to teach the university high school classes that came for training. You see, the teacher's training had the university high school classes come, and I was the one that taught them their cooking, because Miss Marlatt thought that it would be wonderful if I had been teaching there in Oklahoma children, that it would be just the thing. So we were in the attic of Lathrop Hall. That was all Miss Marlatt could get. She had a little office on one floor down from the attic that hung out over the dance floor, so that when you interviewed Miss Marlatt or reported or got anything from Miss Marlatt, you hung over the dance floor, and Margaret Dobler was saying, one, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Thump, thump, thump. What a dancers down there. Then the attic had two rooms, one at one end of the attic, one clear across the length of the building, at the other end of the attic, with boards laid along the rafters between one and the other. And they put up all kind of dividers to make rooms, and so I was in one little divider room across the divider from the clothing people that were teaching clothing, so that they had to wait when my class was using the egg beaters. They had to wait for instructions until my egg beaters got through, and then they would take over. There was a good deal of making do with our department. But oh, it was interesting. So the next year I was turned on to university classes. I think they took back then, I think they didn't meet in our department anymore. I think the children went back into the university high school, and we broke the connection, because then I began with the regular.
I think we ought to stop now. I don't think we have more than another. Just continue and pick it up later.
Well, what do you advise?
We've only used up about 4 minutes. I could just start, rewind it and start it over.
What do I do? Do I go to Baltimore?
Yeah, I'd like to go back a little. I really would.
All right, then. So let me. I go back. And I now am trying to be that bridge with Miss Marlatt's hearty encouragement. I'm trying to be that bridge between science and home economics. Miss Marlatt pays my salary, but I go to Dr. McCollum's classes. Mm-hmm. I grade the papers of his class that I am in, and be as much help to him as I can. I enter on my master's degree with him, so I have certain hours off to work at my own things, and so I am started now on a scholarly career in biochemistry as well as home economics. And Dr. McCollum, of course, is an arresting personality. There were many famous people that I would run across afterward in that class I took in biochemistry under Dr. McCollum. A great many who came to the faculty of the University of Wisconsin. Professor Kitt, I remember, was one of them. Larry Graber was one of them who was there in that class. The head of some of the commercial concerns that I encountered later. Oh, it was a famous class as well as a famous teacher. But I was a very favorite in that class, because Dr. McCollum wouldn't let us take notes. He wouldn't let us vary from gazing straight into his eyes. He said, "I want to have your complete attention. How do I know I'm having your complete attention? Unless you look at me. Put that pencil down and look at me as I talk." Well, what did that do for our notebooks? So I sat in the second row. I laid my notebook open in my lap. I used my thumb to go down what would be a wide line, and I took notes. I learned, I practiced at home, and I learned to take notes with my thumb going down my notebook here.
Without looking.
And writing without Oh, I kept my eyes on Dr. McCollum's eyes.
Yeah,
oh, and when I got home, while it was all fresh in my mind, as fast as I could, I copied it into a permanent notebook. Mm-hmm. The class all borrowed my notebook. Nobody else could quite do what I was doing. And they had to have notes too.
Sure.
So I was a very valued member of that mm-hmm. department. Years and years afterward, I asked Dr. McCollum if he'd like to have that notebook. Oh, would he? So I gave him that notebook. And he just reveled in it because he had kept no record at all of what he had lectured about in those early years. And there it was, word for word, as far as I can take these notes down quickly. But he had a peculiar gesture with his hands. It would come down like that with those long, bony fingers spread to emphasize a remark. He looked like Lincoln. He fattened up in later years, but he was just skin and bones in those early years. Lank, and he had a mole on his face like Lincoln did, and those piercing eyes. He reminded all of us as a Lincoln mm-hmm. figure, tall, lank. Well, he was a very sympathetic teacher for my research. I had no idea of research, of course. Mm-hmm. I broke precious equipment, and the head of the department didn't see eye to eye with breaking equipment, so Dr. McCollum had to protect me as a student in the department. And he was very patient with my not knowing anything at all. He taught me the simplest technique, and he had me verify. He would give me an assignment to do as a kind of a class exercise where the assay would be known, which is a good way to do it. And I came out with very respectable figures on these assays. And he began to trust me more and more, and he gave me some unknowns then, which was a thrill. Oh, and it was something that would forward our research. Miss Davis, of course, was a part of that department, and I didn't have any contact at first with the animal colony, and then I was given some animal work to do. So I came in contact with Miss Davis, and as I told you, she lived in our mm-hmm. apartment house there at the Irving, so I got quite well acquainted with her. When we went to Baltimore, then Miss Marlatt had her transferred to her department. Miss Davis
yeah.
became a part of her department, mm-hmm. so that Miss Davis's value more or less evaporated because she had gone along with Dr. McCollum's ideas. She had gone under his direction as far as the laboratory went, but had wonderful ideas. He would listen sympathetically. She had perfectly wild ideas, but so did he. And so he never knew when she might be suggesting something that would come out as promising as his vitamins did. Mm-hmm. So they were in entire agreement about just soaring into the mm-hmm. blue
yeah.
as far as theory went. So she had a most happy time. But when she came to Miss Marlatt's department, mm-hmm. there was no guidance. Miss Marlatt wasn't able to mm-hmm. Guide her. So her ideas way up in the blue as translated into the work she did in the department mm-hmm. Didn't amount to anything. Mm-hmm. She compiled and compiled and compiled things like x-rays, mm-hmm. things like that. the reason Dr. McCollum didn't take her along with him to Baltimore, he didn't even offer her the chance. The work had got beyond any help that he could get from her, because she could not keep records. And of course that was a dismaying thing. Hmm. So this promising student in his classes more and more took over the record keeping. Nina Simmons
mm-hmm.
was a student in his class. And so without supplanting Marguerite Davis, she more and more took over the real work mm-hmm. that had got way beyond any help of Margaret Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Margaret Davis was still there in command, handled the animals, and had all respect. But it was Nina Simmons around which the real work of the department. So that when it came to transferring to Baltimore, there wasn't any suggestion of Marguerite Davis. And you see, it was very convenient that Miss Marlatt came forward with their offer
mm-hmm.
to transfer her, and Marguerite wanted to stay in Madison.
Sure.
And so it was a logical transfer
mm-hmm.
that she then went to home economics, and Nina Simmons then
sure.
went to Baltimore.
How did Miss Davis feel about it?
Well, apparently all right. As far as I have any memory, that seemed to be all right, because as I say, she wanted to stay in Madison.
Yeah,
Miss Marlatt's salary was the first salary she'd ever received. You see, Professor Hart
right.
refused
yeah.
to have any woman in his department.
Mm-hmm.
So that Miss Davis's work with Dr. McCollum was paid with whatever he could pay her, but she contributed, there was very little of anything that she got.
Mm-hmm.
And so this salary for Miss Marlatt was an amazing thing to her. You see how it would seem like a wonderful bonanza.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently there were no hard feelings. Apparently it was all right. And Dr. McCollum still kept that idealized picture of that woman without any salary that had gone on and on in the difficult early days. She had kept the animals alive. He kept, to some extent, he kept some record of what went on, which he didn't want to have to do. He wanted an assistant who would do that. And Nina Simmons came on to fill that bill. So apparently, there wasn't any discarding of her exactly, but because this offer came when the whole thing was being built up, and so it wasn't that she was discarded in a way. You see, he still kept that idealized thought
sure.
of what she had contributed without being able to let her go on in this new job. So you see, it all worked out all right. And she had her beautiful strong points, but she had such limitations that his thought of her isn't idealized.
Mm, I see.
Thought. She wasn't that good.
She wasn't. Well, where did her strengths lie? You know, she must have had something, I assume.
Well, it's in that she carried on the experiment. She didn't keep the record of it, which was the bad part.
Right. Yeah,
but she handled the animals. She observed. She could talk to Dr. McCollum about what she observed. The animals were kept, and the colony was beautifully kept. She stayed there without salary. Mm-hmm. She came at all hours of the week, and was utter devotion that kept the experiments alive. You don't realize how much that means.
I guess it must really mean quite a bit.
Oh my, so that the appreciation was not overdone.
I see. I'm beginning to get an understanding of that whole situation.
But the limitations he never had in mind very much, because Nina Simmons came right in.
I see.
And supplied all that Miss Davis lacked.
Sure.
So, so that I hope that gives you the picture that what Miss Davis contributed was just utterly invaluable, but she couldn't progress to an unlimited extent in the work.
Yeah, I understand that now. Now, other than, I assume, a higher salary, what were the other factors in McCollum's decision to leave and go back and go to Hopkins?
Well, I think it was the, he went for an interview with what the one we called Popsy Welch. Professor Welch is one of the famous of the world.
Sure.
And Popsy Welch had established this Department of Public Health there. That was his child. That was his pride to add that on to Hopkins. He was allowed only a basement room for it down under the medical school. Oh, very primitive quarters. But Dr. McCollum went on to interview Popsy Welch, and Popsy Welch was a charmer. Oh, that funny little plump man. He was just delicious and delightful. We had a good deal of contact with him. He charmed wherever he went, and he had Dr. McCollum in the hollow of his hand. Dr. McCollum came back talking of nothing but Popsy Welch and this new wonderful enterprise that was going to really save the world. You see, here was Dr. McCollum's knowledge that nutrition was unlocked now in his work, and it could save the world. Well, Popsy Welch painted a picture of how the Department of Public Health at Johns Hopkins was going to be just that. And so, you see, it was very logical. He would, Dr. Welch made him feel important as the head of a department, too. And he hadn't had much distinction here at Wisconsin under Professor Hart. See, he hadn't been able to have his say-so in the budget or a great many things, so that he didn't have freedom as he was promised at Johns Hopkins. So it was all very logical. There are other little contributing things, but that is the very essence of it. And so my salary, as a matter of fact, was less than I was getting at Wisconsin here. He painted this beautiful picture to me, and I kind of got kind of the feeling of its wonders too, because there wasn't there's practically no salary connected with it. As a matter of fact, I had my father come for an operation, and I can't remember how it came about, but there was some dispute about what the operation would cost, because he was a physician. And they went to the authorities at Hopkins to find out what my salary was. And it was so ghastly a salary that they didn't charge my father anything for the operation. It was really quite ghastly. So, but it was interesting.
There's a question that I wanted to ask, and that was, even before the public or semi-public controversy between various figures here, what kind of personal relations, did you witness between all of these principal people?
Well, they were prima donnas. What could you expect? That's what Dr. Elvium said when it came to having to have a new head after Professor Hart's death. Dr. Elvium was talked to me quite casually about it when they were making the decision, and he said, "Well, what have you? Everyone in this department is a prima donna. That's our glory. You can't point to another department of the like of ours in the United States. There are a few famous people, and then there are others." He said, "Here, Wisconsin has all prima donnas in this department." And it was offered them, the head of the department was offered to each one in the department, and because all could have been the head of the department. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Alvim said, when it came my turn, I said, "I will interview each one and let you know." And so he said, I went to each person's office, I sat down, and I said to each prima donna in turn, "What would be your feeling about my being the head of this department? How would you react? What would you do if I became head? What's your worst?" And he said he interviewed every single one, and nobody wanted it. So when he had agreed with each person what would be the worst that they would do to him, he said, then he said, "I caught the flu and I was in bed, and then I was interviewed in bed with a high fever," and he said, "otherwise I wouldn't have ever been." No, that was when he was president. No, at the head of the department. That, I've got ahead of my story. That was when he was president, they came to interview him, and he said, "I never in my right mind would have consented to be the president. But I was sick of bed with a high fever, and I had to get rid of them. I said, yes, yes, yes."
Oh.
But he took on the head of the, I don't think that anything more is needed than a whole glorious bunch of prima donnas. I don't think any other explanation is needed.
I'll leave that up to you. Let's see, where does this bring us? Plenty left. Excuse me.
Well, I've gone to...
You've gone to Hopkins.
I've gone to Hopkins.
Now, how long, what were the, what did you do there, and how long did you stay?
Well,
so on.
I was given supposedly a research position, but Miss Simmons was adequate for nearly all of it. She, of course, had the whole of the animal work. So I prepared the rations. There was a good deal of science to some of those preparations, so it did need somebody that was responsible and had a conscience about it. So for a while I was satisfied with that, and then Dr. McCollum had many public health connections. That is, for instance, we hired a University of Chicago woman to do a survey, which was very popular at that time, a survey of the school children of Baltimore. Everybody was doing a survey, a health survey. They weighed, they measured, they didn't take blood samples in those days, but they did what they could. And so I was a go-between between Dr. McCollum and things like that. I can't remember all of the, I remember he was asked to put on many demonstrations. I was the person that put on those demonstrations. For instance, Hopkins, let's see, what was that connection? There was some, I guess it was in the medical school. They put on, the medical school each year put on a public display to educate the people, the public of Baltimore. Dr. McCollum was assigned a display of nutrition for the people of Baltimore. I went down there, I planned it out, and then I submitted it to him. We were to take milk, which was of course the big thing in those days. Milk and green leaves were it for years. So I took, I planned my display, and I had little bottles, a row of little bottles showing how much there would be in this bottle of milk, how much there would be of protein, of milk sugar, of everything down the row of all the ingredients of milk. And so then I had a double row showing this equal weight, I think it was, of meat, what there would be in this bottle, in this bottle, in this bottle, in this bottle. Then I went down and put it all up, but you understand that Johns Hopkins was essentially Jewish in those days. The big men there, a great many of them were Jewish. So the man that was overseeing this came and looked at my display, this row of bottles. They were all taken out, the protein was all taken out of the same bottle for milk and for meat. I didn't have milk and meat. I had a great big sign, milk and meat, and then I had these bottles all taken out of the same bottle, the calcium taken out, and he said they couldn't stand on the same table.
Sure.
Milk and meat can't be on the same table.
That's right.
And so I had to wait to finish my display until another table could be brought in, and it had to be
across
kosher. But that application, all out of the same bottle, here was protein. Here was protein representing meat. Here was protein out of the same bottle representing milk. And yet they had to be across the room. We had to be kosher. Oh, I remember that incident. It's such amusement.
It is. It's the only way to look at it, you know, ultimately.
Oh, when we were kosher in those days.
That's funny.
So I was the link between Dr. McCollum and a good many of the public things. Then we had various connections with other departments. There was that perfectly wonderful connection between Dr. McCollum and Dr. Park. Dr. Park in the medical school, he's another of the very international famous, I can't remember his front name, but he's in any biographical dictionary, Dr. Park. And Dr. Park had for years and years studied rickets. It was the great unknown, and he was a pediatrician, and it was the great unknown in pediatrics. And Dr. McCollum had the one mystery with animals, rickety bones. And it was just simply like an explosion of something when those two people got together and found that the medical, pediatric, and the animal work came close together. Now, Miss Simmons' work was so utterly reliable and thorough, though they had no connection through all the years with what those bones meant. Her records of autopsying every animal, there wasn't an animal that wasn't autopsied on death, that she didn't take notes on. You see, there is where Marguerite could never have done it. But they got out, Dr. McCollum had taken all his records. That's one thing that made the eternal enmity. He had taken all his books of records, which I think was right. After all, they were his records.
Sure.
Professor Hart insisted they were his records. So, but anyway, Dr. McCollum had taken all his books that Nina Simmons had kept all those years to Baltimore. He and Professor Park sat down, spread out everything,